Blog Talk Radio.
Wonderful. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, and welcome to our next session of our spirituality class and Blog Talk Radio. Let me begin by just doing a quick announcement that tomorrow evening, that's Thursday evening, we're going to be having a fabulous film that really picks up on the themes of what we're going to be talking about tonight. The movie is called Body and Soul, and it's a film about the relationship between the people of Israel and the land of Israel. And although much of the emphasis is going to be on the political and the historical and connection, I'm sure we'll also touch on the topic that we're going to be discussing tonight, which is the spiritual connection between the people of Israel and the land of Israel, and the symbolism and significance of the land of Israel in our spiritual life. It is a reality that is also a metaphor that's also a reality. I know that sounds very cryptic, but I will be unpacking that in the course of our study together. So the first text that I want to share with you is taken from the book of Genesis. It's chapter 12 in the book of Genesis. And it is the birth of the Jewish people. The Lord said to Abram, "Go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse him that curses you, and all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you." Now, this is the birth of the Jewish people, as I mentioned. Incorporated into this small, short passage are the three fundamental realities or fundamental poles, the Trinity, so to speak, of Jewish identity, and that is Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, and Torat Yisrael, the people of Israel, the land of Israel, and the Torah of Israel. It is go to the land that I will show you. There's Eretz Yisrael. I will make of you a great nation. That's Am Yisrael. And the fact that God is giving these commandments to Abram, to Avram, is indicative of the Torah of Israel, the teaching. So all of that is packed into that one verse. All right. But what I would like you to think about, and of course this sets in motion the whole geographical and political and historical association that our people have with the land of Israel. But I'd like you to look at this passage from a spiritual perspective as well, because it's not only go to the land and I'll show you and you're going to live there. Okay, you know, Italians live in Italy, French people live in France. That's not particularly unique. People belong to whatever country they belong to. But something is supposed to happen to us as a result of our being in the land of Israel. All right. If Abram does what God told him to do, "I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing." Right. Whenever I hear this, I think of the Debbie Friedman song, of course, "May She Rest in Peace," that wonderful song. But you shall be a blessing. Right. This is an invitation to a spiritual transformation. You know, you will not merely be a resident in a particular geographical area. You will not merely be a part of a particular ethnic group. You will be something that you wouldn't really expect somebody to be, and that is a blessing. And not only will you be a blessing, sort of broadly speaking, you know, like nice guy, but you will be the kind of blessing that, in a sense, the whole world will seem to revolve around you. All right? "I will bless those who bless you and curse him that curses you, and all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you." So if you look at this, forget about our history for a second. Forget about, you know, the geography. Forget about, you know, Lod Airport. And just think about this idea that you will be not just a blessing, but you will be sort of the decisive blessing. Those that bless you will be blessed. Those that curse you will be cursed. And that, in fact, all of the people of the world are going to be focused on you and bless themselves by you. This is a description not of geography, but of profound spirituality. Right? This is the kind of thing that one would imagine somebody like, you know, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, you know, that's how, you know, you would imagine somebody to have that power, that all of the nations of the earth would bless themselves by you. And that is this is like, welcome to my world. Yeah, this is the invitation to what it means to be a Jew. Now, if built into our national existence in the land of Israel, if built into that is this unique status of blessing in the world, let us consider what it means to be exiled from the land. Because if you are exiled from the land, you are no longer in that position that you were in before. Okay, it's punishment, but beyond punishment is catastrophe. Right? It's not just that, you know, miserable things are going to happen to you. The entire world is out of order. And if you look at the next passage, this is from Jeremiah, home of the Jeremiad. Jeremiah obviously is writing in connection to the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem. And I want you to think, as we are reading through this, think about it on the one hand, the way we naturally think about it, which is a description of the horrible social disruption that took place, you know, when the temple was destroyed, you know, when our people were driven into exile and so forth. All right, so think about all of that. But also, imagine this as a description of an individual state of mind, separate from the destruction of the temple. Just imagine an individual feeling the way that Jeremiah describes in this passage. My heart moans within me. I cannot be silent, for I hear the blare of horns, alarms of war. Disaster overtakes disaster, for all of the land has been ravaged. Suddenly my tents have been ravaged, in a moment my tent cloths. How long must I see standards and hear the blare of horns? For my people are stupid, they give me no heed. They are foolish children, they are not intelligent. They are clever at doing wrong, but unable to do right. I look at the earth, it is unformed and void, at the skies, and their light is gone. I look at the mountains, they are quaking, and all the hills are rocking. I look, no man is left, and all the birds of the sky have fled. I look, the farmland is desert, and all its towns are in ruin, because of the Lord, because of his blazing anger. For thus said the Lord, the whole land shall be desolate, but I will not make an end of it, for this the earth mourns. Okay. So, as I said, this describes perfectly the horrible situation of our ancestors when they're experiencing exile, the end of the temple being destroyed, and so forth. But think about it now as a psycho-spiritual statement. Think about what it would mean for an individual to feel this way. Okay. What do we have here? We have a guttural, you know, the primal scream, my heart moaning, I cannot be silent. Okay. A sense of disaster overtaking disaster. It's just one thing after another. There's a sense of profound personal violation. My tents have been ravaged, my tent cloths. All right, somebody's torn open my tent. Right. And here is God now condemning the people. My people are stupid, they give me no heed, they're foolish children. But it's also the person who is themselves spiritually disoriented, thinking about themselves as they realize how out of joint their lives are, how poor their spiritual life is, how misdirected their spiritual life is. I was lost, but now I'm found, right? It's that sense of being lost, right? They're clever at doing wrong, but unable to do right. That sense of being trapped in a world of sort of spiritual ignorance. And then we have this next passage. I look at the earth, it is unformed and void, at the skies, and their light is gone. What's he making reference here to?
Creation.
It's a reversal of the creation story. Okay, remember, God saw the earth and it was formless and void, and then he said, let there be light. Well, now there's no light. Now we're back to chaos again. So, exile from the land can be seen as a metaphor for an individual who is forced out of his stable situation where he would be a blessing and the whole world would center around him, right? Because he would be such a blessing and the whole world would bless themselves by him. And now we're in a situation that instead of this sort of perfectly ordered concentric circles of blessings, we now have this total chaos where the light has gone out of the world, the mountains are quaking, there's no order at all. There's just a profound sense of disorder. And now, by contrast, we turn to our next passage, which you'll see on page 2. And this is from the prophet Isaiah, and it describes now the redemption. Okay? Fear not. And again, read this, number one, as a prophecy to a people in exile, talking about their soon-to-occur geographical transport from being in exile to their return to their homeland, on the one hand. So again, read it as a personal spiritual status report. Fear not, for I am with you. I will gather your folk from the east, will gather you out from the west. I will say to the north, give back, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. All who are linked to my name, whom I have created, formed and made for my glory, setting free that people, blind though it has eyes, and deaf though it has ears. All the nations assemble as one, the people gather. Who among them declared this, foretold to us the things that have happened? Let them produce their witnesses and be vindicated, that men hearing them may say, it is true. My witnesses are you, declares the Lord. My servant, whom I have chosen, to the end that you may take thought and believe in me and understand that I am he. Before me no God was formed, and after me none shall exist, none but me, the Lord. Beside me none can grant triumph. I alone foretold the triumph, and I brought it to pass. I announced it, and no strange God was among you. So you are my witnesses, declares the Lord. Okay. So again, on the one hand, on the national level, it's easy to see what he's talking about, that, I'm going to gather you up from all of the exiles, I'm going to return you to the land, you're going to accept me as your God, no more idolatry in the picture, and you will be my witness of the fact that I've brought you back to the land. Well, you will now, in your right living, you will be witnesses to my sovereignty, and that restores the sort of national blessing. Great. But now let's look at it again from the personal, psycho-spiritual perspective. That one of the things that the feeling of being in exile, the feeling of alienation, is the feeling of being scattered, that you are not whole. And that what you need to do to overcome your lack of wholeness is to be able to reintegrate your various psychological, spiritual parts. Right. Jung actually refers to it as integration. Right. That instead of being sort of psychologically dissociated, right, that instead you're somehow put into an integrated whole. You become that one again. Okay. And in doing this, and here we see a parallel, a meeting point with Jeremiah, who talked about the stupid people who don't know, who don't understand, foolish children, not intelligent, clever at doing wrong, but unable to do right. Here, Isaiah is picking up on the same theme. Blind, this people, blind though it has eyes and deaf though it has ears. Okay, so you're recognizing your limitations, your inabilities, your lack of spiritual enlightenment. But in the Jeremiah, you're going downhill from there. In the Isaiah, you're going uphill. You know, you're rising up. All right, because all of the nations will gather together, and you know what they're going to say? They're going to say, guess what? You are the witness. It is you. You are the one. So, again, as a matter of spiritual awareness, the idea that you know, an adept in any kind of religious order, they go in thinking that they're everything. Then they have to learn that they're nothing. And then they have to learn that they really are everything, because they know that they're nothing. Right. So here, you know, guess what? You may not understand this, but you are the witness. You are the one that has knowledge of the divine. All right. You were the one that is chosen, so that you may take thought and believe in me and understand all of these things. There's a kind of, you know, although this is a little bit out of time order, it's gnosis, as in Gnosticism. It's the knowledge of the divine reality. Understand that I am He. I am God. Before me, no God was formed. After me, none shall exist. So you are understanding the sort of the reality of eternity, the reality of God's eternal presence. None but me, the Lord. Beside me, none can grant triumph. I alone foretold the triumph. I brought it to pass. I announced it. No strange God was among you. Okay. So that there is this incredible awareness of the unchallenged power of God, and that you will understand it enough to be able to be the witnesses of it. Again, on the national level, you know, this is a rather odd angle to take on the national level. You know, when you think about a speech in the Knesset, this is not what you expect them to be talking about. So you have to ask yourself the question, well, where exactly does this sort of religious manifestation, where does that come into the picture if all we're talking about is this sort of national, historical, political, geographical return to the land?
More
secular. Yeah. The secular stuff, where, you know, that I understand. Where does this come into the picture? Right. And the argument that I'm going to make is that this is meant to be an internal kind of spiritual transformation, that the national transformation, the physical, geographical, political, historical, and the internal, personal, spiritual transformation are parallel and linked to each other. Okay, everybody following so far? Okay. So, when the temple was destroyed, we have this incredible passage from the Talmud from Baba Batra on the lower left-hand side. An amazing story. When the temple was destroyed, large numbers in Israel became ascetics, binding themselves neither to eat meat nor to drink wine. Rabbi Joshua got into a conversation with them and said, "My sons, why do you not eat meat?" They replied, "Shall we eat flesh, which used to be brought daily as an offering on the altar, now that this altar is in abeyance? Shall we drink wine, which used to be poured out as a libation on the altar, but now no longer?" He, that is Rabbi Yeshua, he said to them, "If that is so, we should not eat figs or grapes either, because there's no longer an offering of first fruits. We should not drink water, because there's no longer any ceremony of the pouring of the water." To this they could find no answer, because obviously, you know, you don't want to eat the wine, you know, well, don't eat anything. Don't drink anything. Right? This is not going to work. So he said to them, "Not to mourn at all is impossible, because the blow has fallen. To mourn over much is also impossible." You know, in other words, if you just curl up and die, well, guess what? You die. "The sages therefore have ordained thus. A man may stucco his house, but he should leave a little bare in memory of Jerusalem. A man may prepare a full course banquet, but he should leave out an item or two in memory of Jerusalem. For it is said, 'If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I remember thee not, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy.'" So, from the national, historical, political, and now halachic point of view, what we have here is the main source for what's called Zecher Lechorban, the remembrance of the destruction of the temple. So you have one, there's one example that everybody knows. They don't realize that this is what they're seeing, but it's the one example that everybody does know. When you break a glass at the end of a wedding, right? Because Jerusalem is supposed to be above our highest joy. A wedding is obviously an incredibly joyous occasion. There's a real temptation that at that particular moment you would put this wedding and the joy of the wedding higher than your joy about Jerusalem. So as a reminder, right at this peak moment, you break the glass as a reminder to put Jerusalem first. Okay? But that is only one of many kinds of Zecher Lechorban, of remembrance of the Chorban. So they mentioned two others here. The idea of leaving, you know, when you paint your house, you should leave a little portion of one of the walls unpainted. Okay. Or that you should, when you have a festive meal, you should leave off one of the courses as a Zecher Lechorban. Right. What we do, we haven't done it yet because we haven't hung our stuff, but we have a Roman Vishniak picture of the Krakow ghetto, right? That, you know, we have on the wall specifically as Zecher Lechorban, right? And also the Tower in York, where there was one of the first massacres of Jews in England. You know, we have a picture of that tower as well. So that, you know, we look at that and it's Zecher Lechorban. And I do, one of my favorite stories, there was a wonderful teacher I had in Jerusalem, R.J. Svi Verblovsky, a wonderful scholar, incredible scholar, and also an Israeli diplomat. And when you walked into his house in Jerusalem, that, like, you opened the door and there was this, like, long corridor towards the back of the house. And at the end of the long corridor, with a light shining on it, was one of the yellow badges, yellow Jewish stars from the Holocaust. Okay? So when you walked in the house, that's what you saw in front of you. So, you know, you can imagine when you invite diplomats over to the house, that's the first thing they see when they walk in. You know, let them know whose house they're walking into. Right? So you have the Zecher Lechorban. Okay? So this is all well and good. It's a great national thing. It's how we keep it all alive, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? I should also mention that when we do Birkat HaMazon, we all know that, like, on Shabbos and the holidays, you do Shir HaMalot. Shir HaMalot, Peshuv Adonai. You know, when God returned us to Zion, we were his dreamers. Okay? What most people don't know is that when you do it on the weekday, you do Psalm 137. All right, which is the one that you have right here.
It's your benching after certain foods. The whole thing almost is about Israel.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, the Birkat HaMazon is very definitely about Israel, because you thank God, Al Ha'aretz, V'Al HaMazon, for the land and for the food. Notice that you put the land first. Okay. So, and thanking God for the food would be the most, you know, natural and common thing in the world. That you thank God for the land first. That's the sort of unique, distinguishing characteristic. Okay, that's all well and good. But now I want to look at this again from a psycho-spiritual point of view. Right. Once the alienation has taken place, once the catastrophe has befallen, right, on the one hand, you just want to curl up and die. Right. You just don't want to go on. And what has to happen in terms of your spiritual life is that you don't simply wallow in it, right? You wallow in your unenlightened state. To the contrary, you recognize, yes, I find myself now in an unenlightened state. I am, in fact, exiled. I am, in fact, alienated from the spiritual world. All right? So what do? Well, I keep in mind my alienation. I don't pretend that I am not alienated. I don't try and, like, drink it away or just get busy at work. You know, I recognize the distance that I have, all right? But I have to remember, I have to recollect. Again, there's that image of collecting. I have to recollect that highest joy. I have to recollect the experience of being in that high and exalted place. And I will have, I need to not get trapped into this world of exile and imagine that this world of exile is really normal for me. What I need to do is I have to have these reminders to keep me aware of the fact that I am now in exile, because otherwise I'll get used to being in exile. And if I get used to being in exile, then I'll never transcend the spiritual state that I'm in. I'll never get, you know, back to a transcendent level. I'll be trapped here, and I'll even forget that I ever was anywhere. There is a fabulous a Gnostic hymn that's roughly contemporaneous with this Talmudic passage that occurs to me, called the Hymn of the Pearl. And the idea in the Hymn of the Pearl is that you let's call it an angel comes from God to free the pearl that has been trapped in Egypt. And the pearl is actually a soul that's forgotten who it is and what it is. And so the angel comes as this divine messenger to tell the pearl who the pearl is really divine. But the problem is that the angel himself can get trapped in Egypt and forget who he is. And so God now has to send yet another angel to get the message. And of course, the people who are reading this Hymn of the Pearl, the message to them is, you are the pearl. You need to wake up and remember who you are. So from a spiritual point of view, when we do our Zekar of the Korban, it's not only a recollection of, oh yes, 2,000 years ago the temple was destroyed. It's also a recollection of our own current alienation and our own current need to get out of that alienation. So if you turn the page, what you have here are two very powerful piyutim. Now, a piyut, the simple definition of a piyut are the long and incomprehensible prayers that you have on Yom Kippur, okay, that do not translate very well because they've got a very repetitive style, and they're often making allusions to very learned allusions, word plays to dozens, hundreds of biblical events and verses that most of us would not know anything about when we first look at it. But underneath all of that, there's in fact an incredibly powerful message that's being passed on. So if you look on the left-hand side, this is taken from Rabbi Meshulam Kalonymus around the year 975. And it is a prayer that comes at the after the description of how the high priest looked, how the Kohen Gadol looked when he came out of the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. And he would come out and he would be so radiant and he would look like the evening star, and there's a very flowery description. And then you have this incredibly powerful poetic prayer. Happy the eye that saw our temple and the joy of our assembly. Verily to hear of it makes our soul sad. Happy the eye that saw the musicians of every kind of instrument that we were playing in the temple. Happy the eye that saw the appointed habitation wherein the living presence dwelt. That should be presence with a P, talking about the presence of God. Happy the eye that saw the joy in the place of water drawing, a people in drawing freely of the Holy Spirit. So that there was a special ceremony called the Simchat Beit HaShoevah, a water pouring ceremony, where it was a special sort of people's libation of water onto the altar. And it was considered the happiest day of the year in ancient Israel. And the parallel is drawn as just as the water is being poured out on the altar, so God's Spirit is being poured out on the people. And that's a real good example of the kind of metaphor that we're talking about here geographical, political, historical sense. Water in the Middle East is this incredibly precious thing. So when you're pouring water on the altar, it's water that you're celebrating. Right? But from a spiritual point of view, being able to do that is parallel to God's Spirit pouring out over the people. Those two things are linked to each other. So happy are the people that see all of this or saw all of this. But through the iniquities of our fathers, the temple is in ruins. Because of the multitude of our sins, we have no burnt offerings, no sin offerings, no holy of holies, no incense, no palace, no sprinkling, no confession, no immersion, no cleansing, no Jerusalem, no temple, no altar, no cover of the holy ark, no Zion, no high priest, no Aaron and his descendants to bless the people. Okay, so it's this gut-wrenching sense of loss and absence. So if you, again, we move that over now from bemoaning of our loss of national sovereignty, et cetera, to looking at it now from an internal, from a spiritual point of view. Okay, there was a time, and we have within us, right, that sense of the indwelling of the living presence. We've been to a place where God dwells. Okay, we've been to that place where there's an outpouring of the Holy Spirit. We've experienced that, or you know, either me personally, or I know that there is such a place. Right. But look where I find myself, without this, without that, without this, without that. All of the things that could have gotten me there, I don't have. Right. So in order to get to that higher level, what I have to do in a sense is reconstruct those places. I've got to be able to get myself back to Israel. I've got to rebuild all of this. Not necessarily in the physical sense of rebuilding the temple brick by brick or stone by stone, but getting back to the place where there is a sense of living presence, where I hear this incredible, you know, the harmony of the musicians that I can see, that I can have an image of the temple. That's what I would need to do to be able to restore myself. The question is, how do I get there? Because it's a catch-22. Normally, what I would do to be able to get there would be to go to the temple. All right? But now I find I go to the temple to have the experience of being at the temple. Now that the temple is destroyed, I have no temple to be able to go to be able to have the experience of being at the temple. So I'm trapped here. And when you look at medieval rabbinic discussions about Israel and about exile, there's this extraordinary feeling of being trapped. Of it doesn't matter how hard we pray, like the door is closed. Right? There's no way for us to break out of where we are. And that's why there's this kind of desperate hope for a restoration to the land, which is parallel to a desperate hope for a restoration of my soul, of an inner restoration. So look on the other side of page 3. This is another piyut, but this comes from the Kinot for Tisha B'Av. Okay, this is on Tisha B'Av. There are a series of gut-wrenching kinot, prayers of lamentation. In this, the Paitan, that person who writes piyutim, contrasts the condition of the people when they went forth from Egypt, that is, when Israel dwelt in its own land, with their condition when they went forth from Jerusalem, that is, when they were forced out into exile. The vision of the glory of God was as a consuming fire when I went forth from Egypt, but as a sharpened sword unsheathed for slaughter when I went forth from Egypt. Oh. Yeah, that should be from Jerusalem. Sabbath, festivals, signs and wonders when I went forth from Egypt, fast days and mourning when I went forth from Jerusalem. Jubilee year and sabbatical year and a tranquil land when I went forth from Egypt, sold forever and slaved for eternity when I went forth from Jerusalem. Levites and Aaronides, priests, and 70 elders when I went forth from Egypt, persecutors, aggressors, slave trade when I went forth from Jerusalem. holiness and prophecy and the visible glory of God when I went forth from Egypt, filth and contamination and the spirit of defilement when I went forth from Jerusalem. Now, it is an amazing poem. But it so beautifully captures both the historical reality of the enslavement and the degradation and so forth, and the tremendous sense of loss of the institutions that we had, of the Jubilee year and the sabbatical year, you know, they carried with them, you know, the freeing of slaves and the excusing of debts and restoration of land, and, you know, all these wonderful institutions. And the vision of the glory of God as a consuming fire. But again, seeing it now as an internal condition, right, focusing it on the Jubilee year and sabbatical year and a tranquil land, there was a time, or there could be a time, where I could experience harmony, balance, a return to origins, because that's, you know, the seven-year cycle, the cycle of seven years, coming back to that same point. That's what the whole sabbatical year is supposed to be about. So I know that that's possible. I know that I can have a vision of the glory of God instead of what I'm stuck with now. And what the people are experiencing because of their exile from, or what we are experiencing because of our exile from Jerusalem, right, that's what I am experiencing in my own personal spiritual life because of my own internal exile. Right? And so here's what I know. Right now I'm feeling filth and contamination and a spirit of defilement. What I know is that there's this thing called holiness and prophecy and the visible glory of God. And that's where I have to try and go. So every time it talks about going back to Israel, what they're talking about is not only making aliyah in the sense of, you know, grabbing, you know, getting a ticket on El Al, but they're making an internal aliyah, arising up out of this condition of degradation and so forth. Okay. And one of the places where you can see how these two, the national and the individual, come together is when we look at Yehuda Halevi's theory on prophecy. Yehuda Halevi comes up with a really fascinating idea. He says that different nations have a sort of an intrinsic ability to do what they do. Something about where they are, their land, the air that you breathe, where they are, it allows them to do X. Okay, so the Greeks, something about being there makes them great philosophers. Right? The Romans, something about being there makes them like great administrators, great army generals. You know, it just comes. You know, they somehow know how to do it. Okay, what do Jews do? We do prophecy. And if you think about it for a second, it's a really interesting thing. There are various kinds of like oracles and you know, divine shaman figures in virtually every culture on the planet. I don't know of any parallel to Jeremiah and Isaiah. You know, these great rhetoricians playing this role of guiding the people, inspired by God while they're doing, you know, passing on the word of God. That there's nothing like it. Yeah, well, where do you think he got it from? As a matter of fact, you know, we read about Jesus reading Isaiah he's in the tribe. You know, he's just keeping up with the trend. That's what we do.
Yeah, I'm not talking about Christianity. I'm talking about Jesus.
I understand that. I'm sorry.
Yes,
I'm pretty sure that he was asked to read, if I remember the story correctly, you know, he came into the synagogue and they asked him to read something, so he picked up a scroll, and what he was reading was Isaiah, if I'm not mistaken. But one of the prophets, certainly, that's what he was reading there, okay? So, yeah, I mean, they were the model for him, all right? You know, he's one of ours. Of course he would know how to do this, and he was doing it in Israel. Of course he would know how to do that. All right, so Yehuda Halevi has this theory that it's, prophets are what the land of Israel produces. Right, which means that if you're not in the land of Israel, well, then you lose the spirit of prophecy. So, here's Yehuda Levi on the top of page 4. We have also seen that after the exile, prophecy did not dwell among the nation. Which is not to say that this was because of the exile and its woes. For at certain times under the righteous kings, there was gladness and rejoicing when every person could enter his home in peace. Rather, the matter was like what the Chaver wrote to the Khuzari king. Don't worry about that right now. That the prophets all prophesied in the land of Israel or for her sake in accordance with the scripture statement, her king and princes are among the nations and have no instruction, nor have her prophets found the Lord's vision. That is to say, even those prophets who were in a state of preparedness received no vision because such was God's will. Translating all of that into English, okay, the reason that we don't have prophets after the exile is not because we're suffering in exile. Because there were some times when we were in exile and it wasn't so terrible. Okay? But rather, the king, the Lord has basically said that even people that you know, theoretically could be prophets, right? If they're outside of Israel, he's just not going to let them be prophets. Right? Prophecy is something that you do in the land of Israel. Right? It has this unique kind of status. So, again, you could look at this from an historical point of view, that the institution of the Nevi'im, of the prophets, that with the exile from Israel, that destroyed the social structure, you no longer had the ability to do it, blah, blah, blah. So that's the national sort of historical thing. On the other hand, what it means is that even if you are in a state of preparedness to become a prophet, you don't get it when you're outside the land of Israel. All right. So here, imagine the frustration of somebody who works at it, but just is never called upon to who doesn't receive it. You know, it's a variant on the, you know, many are called, but few are chosen. You know, you might be called, but you're not going to be chosen if you're out there, you know, because the alienation is such that your ability, you can't command God to talk to you. All right, so if you don't, you know, you could have it, but you know, you can prepare for it, but what are you going to do? So Yehuda Levi, who besides being a wonderful philosopher, was also a great poet, he writes the following poem. It's a classic. My heart is in the east, and I in the uttermost west. And he's writing this, by the way, when he's in Spain. How can I find savor in food? How shall it be sweet to me? How shall I render my vows and my bonds, while yet Zion lieth beneath the fetter of Edom, and I in Arab chains? A light thing would it seem to me to leave all the good things of Spain, seeing how precious in mine eyes to behold the dust of the desolate sanctuary. It's one of the great poems of longing for Zion. And the reason I want to emphasize it is the sense of scattered, of being torn apart. My heart is in the east and I in the uttermost west. It's hard to find a more succinct statement of a spiritual disorientation or a spiritual alienation than something like this. You know, I'm here, my heart's there. So what's the whole point of spirituality is avodat halev. It's the service of the heart. It's what's the, you know, it's supposed to be inside of you, and here by contrast, it's as far away as it could possibly be. That's what exile means. All right. Now, I was talking before about the sense of catastrophe, that it's a national catastrophe, but it's also a personal catastrophe. It's also a cosmic catastrophe, which plays with the personal. In one of the main medieval ideas is the link between the microcosm and the macrocosm. The macrocosm is the big world out there. The microcosm is the individual. And the idea that what's happening with the individual is, and what's happening with the big universe out there, run in parallel with each other. This is sort of the basic idea behind astrology, is that, you know, if you were born at such and such a, you know, a time with, you know, the stars over here and Jupiter over there or whatever, that somehow that's reflected in who you are. So you live out the life of the universe as writ large in the stars. Now, that's the basic idea. So here we have this incredible idea that reflects, again, this link between the national, geographical, historical, political entity and the individual, but also the cosmos as a whole. So Rabbi Ezra ben Solomon, who was a Kabbalist in what was called the School of Girona, there were several different Kabbalistic schools, that was one of them. We read, "The inner line of the populated world is the land of Israel, which is called the navel of the world. And around it are the 70 nations." Okay, so you have a sense of the world coming into being with the birth of Israel. You know, that's the navel, and you know, that's the sort of the connecting link between the divine and the world. And from us, then you have these 70 nations scattered around. All right. Again, which is a distant echo of what we read about in chapter 12 of Genesis, that the whole world will be blessed by you. And around it there are 70 nations. So also regarding the glorious name, the Shem HaNichbad, the inner line and the heart, the center, are the source of the power of Israel. And around it there are 70 names, and all of them depend upon and are sustained by the efflux, by the flow from the center. So here, in this Kabbalistic view, the flow of divine power into the world comes through Israel, through the geographical place of Israel. This is the reason why the inhabitant of the land of Israel received directly from the land's power and is under its sphere of influence and is similar to someone who has a god. Whereas whoever dwells abroad actually must resort to the flow he receives from the name which is appointed the dominion over him. I'll unpack all of this in a second. I'll unpack it now. So the idea here, we're going to see some examples of this. The idea is that the 70 nations of the world all have their sort of governing angel. Israel is unique by having no governing angel. We have God. So there is an order, like, you know, God is here and all of the angels are there for all of the different nations, but we are unique in that our, so to speak, governing angel is not a governing angel at all, it's God himself. Okay, so the other nations get their power, you know, the angels of the other nations derive their power from God. The other nations derive their power from Israel, and this all works by the flow of divine energy, and that's all coming into the world through Israel. All right, and if you are, and the other idea here is that people who live outside the land of Israel are as if they had no God. All right, the Talmudic statement. We'll see some variants on that theme shortly. So again, being outside of Israel means complete spiritual alienation. You're a person who has no God. All right. But at the time of the resurrection, the souls, even of those who died in the land of Israel, will return through its area using the inner path, which ascends to the inner line of the glorious name, which is called the bundle of life. So at the time of the resurrection, there will be this this recollection, this recalling of all of the dead, and they will then be channeled through the land of Israel and there have access to that flow from which they'd been cut off before, and that's the source of their life. And again, read this now as a personal psycho-spiritual document. All right? Everything comes from this sense of divine flow. And if I'm there, if I have that sense of centering, then the flow is coming into me, and everything around me is now going to be blessed as a result of that flow. But if I am not there, if I am alienated from there, if I've been, you know, kicked out of the land, then that flow is cut off. So I am personally disoriented. Everything around me is now disoriented. All right, and I need a resurrection. I need a tchiyat hametim. I need now to be, you know, not so much reborn, but re-enlivened. I need a life back. the centrality of the land took a further turn in the writing of Nachmanides, of Ramban, who, incidentally, contrary to Maimonides, Nachmanides is of the opinion that settlement in the land of Israel is a mitzvah, is a commandment. Right? Maimonides did not consider it to be a commandment. Nachmanides did consider it to be a commandment. And Nachmanides writes, when God created heaven and earth, he subjected the lower world to the higher and put each people according to their lands and their nations under a planet and a star. As we know from the science of astrology, that is what is meant by the verse, the Lord your God apportioned them to all the peoples. To everyone he apportioned planets in the heavens and put supreme angels above them to rule over them. But the honored God is the God of gods and Lord of lords for all the world. The land of Israel is the center of the inhabited earth and God's own inheritance. So over it he put no angels, nor officers, rulers, or sovereigns. So this, you know, is the idea that I refer to, that over Israel you have direct access to God. Right? When you're out, you're by definition alienated. An even more extreme formulation is attributed by a later author to the Yalkut. This is on page 5. Whoever dwells in the land of Israel is as one who has a God, for he prays to God and God hears his prayer. He is not under the jurisdiction of a constellation. Now here, constellation, angel, star, those are all, you know, parallel ideas. He is not under the jurisdiction of a constellation, but under the power of the Holy One himself. But whoever dwells outside the land of Israel is as one who has no God. For even when he prays to God, God does not hear his prayer, and he is under the jurisdiction of princes and constellations. Now that's an amazing statement. Okay, yeah, see everybody freaking out, right? That's an amazing statement, that God doesn't hear your prayers when you're outside the land. Okay, and it is, I will repeat, an extreme formulation, extreme enough that we're going to see a couple of ways that people try and fudge that. Okay, but it is leaving aside what it says theologically, the claim that is made theologically about God. Again, I want to focus on the personal level. Right? What's the problem with being spiritually alienated? You can pray all you want. God's not hearing you. Right? That's the feeling that you get. I mean, if I wanted to make some kind of parallel to it, I would take the parallel of clinical depression. If you talk to somebody who's clinically depressed, you could say all of the logical things. Oh, you have a wonderful family. Oh, you have a wonderful career. Oh, you're really such a nice guy. Oh, your life is so valuable. You can come up with all, you know, anything you want to say. But when they're in it, they can't hear it. Right? It's just not, it just doesn't register. You could be as well-meaning as you could possibly be, and you're going to be cut off at every turn because you just can't be heard. All right, and that's the feeling that you get when you are outside the land. Now, they probably meant it quite literally, physically, geographically, that when you are geographically outside, you can't be heard. So you continue to pray. You don't mean you stop praying, but you have to understand that your prayers are sort of born into frustration because there's no way that they're going to get through. That's the horrible state in which we find ourselves in exile. Now, just to underscore how radical that is, I'm going to read two quotes here of rabbis who tried to pull back from the brink on this one. So one by Abraham Bibago, writing in Italy, if I'm not mistaken, in the 15th century. The reason why in Spain in the 15th century. The reason why they said that whoever lives outside the land is as one who has no God is that such a person will not have a balanced temperament, and consequently his intellect will not be settled as it would be with a proper corporeal environment. If a person's temperament is not appropriate, he will resist philosophical enlightenment. Okay, so in other words, because, you know, the land of Israel, why was it able to produce all these prophets? Because it is by itself a special kind of a place that is, it's a kind of paradise on earth. It's a kind of place that, that's so balanced that it just, it's like going to down the shore. You know, it's a place that is conducive to philosophical thought, which, following Maimonides, would be considered the equivalent of prophecy. Right. That is why one who dwells outside the land is as one who has no God. It's not because God doesn't hear your prayers. It's that you're not really in a position to give it your best shot. For the land of Israel is moderate for its inhabitants, situated in the fourth climate, I'm not sure exactly what that means, in the center of the inhabited world. Those who are born there and live there will not be frozen by cold nor scorched by heat. Their temperament will therefore be perfect for rational speculation and their intellect clean and pure. Okay, so again, this is sort of following a little bit the Maimonidean model, that it's a practical consideration here. The reason that if you're outside of Israel, it's because no place outside of Israel is as nice as being in Israel. Okay, so this mode of interpreting the rabbinic statement does not imply that it is impossible for anyone outside the land of Israel to attain philosophical enlightenment and thereby to merit God's providential attention. Rather, the conditions outside the land are more difficult. Fewer will reach the aspired level. And therefore, in general, those living in the diaspora will be more likely to be as one who has no God. You know, it's just tougher out here. You know, when you're in Israel, there's a beautiful line, that the air in Israel makes you wise. And I would just mention, you know, parenthetically and anecdotally, personal experience, one of my favorite experiences in Israel was I got into a taxi. All right, so the taxi driver sees that I'm wearing a kippah. So the taxi driver says, "Did you ever read Maimonides' 8 chapters on morality?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, maybe you could explain to me why in chapter 2 he says ba da ba da ba da." All right. Now, can you imagine a taxi driver in New York doing something like that? Okay. But in Israel, it's like, sure, let's discuss philosophy with the taxi driver, right? This is the most natural thing in the world. Right, here they discuss politics, right? And that, forgive me, you could get anywhere, all right? But there's just something about the way the place works, the way it functions, is that you just have this incredible sense of learning. Like when you read Israeli newspapers, right? They are filled with heavy-duty sort of moral, philosophical, religious, theological essays. Right? You know, you see anything like that in the New York Post recently? You know? I don't think so. I mean, you don't see anything like that in the New York Times, really. But here, it's just the most, you know, sort of common thing in the world to do that. So, you know, it's as if the air of Israel actually makes you wise. Right. So Abraham Bibago is saying, you know, it's not that God has cut you off. It's just that you're not, most people are not going to be in good shape. All right. Now, there's another figure, Abraham Abulafia. He is one of the leading figures is what's known as prophetic Kabbalah. And prophetic Kabbalah involves a lot of very intense sort of mental exercises that induce something that vaguely akin to a hypnotic trance. So in Abulafia's opinion, the land of Israel is the body of the righteous man, whereas the term chutzal la'aretz, outside the land, points to the soul, which is different from the body. Therefore, the geographic meaning of the land of Israel is irrelevant in the context of the gifts of prophecy. The divine presence, the Shekhinah, dwells everywhere geographically, although only in someone who is worthy to receive prophetic inspiration. Okay, so here it's a beautiful thing where he says to be in the land of Israel, all right, means to be in the right place spiritually. And you could be living in Baltimore, but if you're in the right place spiritually, you're in the land of Israel. Whereas you could be living in Jerusalem, but if you're in the wrong place spiritually, you might as well be in Nome, Alaska. Okay? So the same rabbinic dictum was interpreted by Rabbi Isaac of Akko, another outstanding Kabbalist, one of the first, who was influenced by the prophetic Kabbalah. I'm sorry. I'm, I confusing. No, Rabbi, he wasn't one of the first. I'm confusing with Isaac the Blind. Rabbi Isaac of Akko, you know, writing in probably the 1400s. In his mystical diary, we read, "The secret of outside the land and of the land of Israel is that the land, the Eretz, does not signify the earth of dust, that is the geographic land, the physical land of Israel, but the lump of dust, that is the human body, in which souls dwell. The land is the palace of the souls, it is flesh and blood. The soul that dwells in earth, that is Haaretz, which derives from Jacob's seed, certainly dwells in the land of Israel." Even so, you know, any soul that's in an enlightened Jew is living in according to this interpretation, is living in the land of Israel. Even if the soul dwells outside the land geographically, the Shekhinah, the presence of God, will rest upon it, since it is definitely in the land of Israel, in the earth of Israel. But the soul which dwells in the land geographically, which does not derive from the seed of Jacob, who is Israel, our father, certainly dwells outside the land, even if it is in the land of Israel, geographically, even inside Jerusalem. Neither the Shekhinah nor the spirit of prophecy will dwell upon it, since it is certainly outside the land. Okay? So here you have this spiritualizing interpretation as if to eliminate the actual geographical land of Israel, and actually to distort its meaning, to say that to be in the land of Israel, according to this interpretation, you don't have to be in the land of Israel. Okay? And even further, you could be in the land, but you're not in the land. And you can, being in the land, but not in the land, or being outside the land, but in the land, outside the land geographically, you could be more in the land of Israel in Nome, Alaska, than somebody in the land, outside the land, living geographically in the land. It's a rather remarkable reinterpretation, powerful reinterpretation. So in Abba Lafia's view, the body of any person who is worthy to receive a prophetic inspiration may be considered as a land of Israel. There is a parallel to that, which I did not quote here, but I'll tell you a wonderful story about it, that Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, the great Hasidic master, once said, "Wherever I go, I'm going to the land of Israel." Okay. Now, what's funny about that is that was picked up in the 1950s and 60s as a Zionist slogan. So you would go to a Zionist conference and there would be a big banner saying, Rabbi Nachman said, "Wherever I go, I'm going to the land of Israel." But if you think about it for a second, the statement is a profoundly anti-Zionist or non-Zionist statement. I don't have to actually go to Israel. All right, I could go to Plotsk, but I'm going to the land of Israel.
That's why they've been having the discussion in France with the people. The rabbi in France was saying that the people should stay and not Netanyahu.
Well, that's not why they're having that discussion there, Mom. They're having that discussion there because they're really caught in the contradictions of Galut.
Right.
They're really caught in the contradictions of Galut. You know, the whole premise of Galut existence in our day is the idea, parentheses, fantasy, end of parentheses, that we can live a secure life when we're out here. And it is assumed that the power of democracy and enlightenment will and political emancipation will somehow protect us. Right? In Europe, increasingly, Jews are finding that to be a fallacious assumption. Right? So that's why they're talking about it there. They're not talking about it in terms of their spiritual well-being and whether or not they could have spiritual well-being while living in France. That's not a topic that Netanyahu is going to have an awful lot to say about. All right? He's not talking about their spiritual well-being. He's talking about their physical well-being.
Right.
Okay, so that's a different that's a different kettle of fish right there. Okay, so. But those last two quotes that we read, the two or three quotes, the Babago quote and the Abba Lafia quote and the Isaac of Akko quote, that all of those are trying to pull back from the brink of saying that being in the land of Israel, physically, geographically in the land of Israel, is somehow essential. All right. One of the takes on this... that sort of moves us back in the direction that I was going in before about the external life being a reflection of the internal life and vice versa. If you see on the next page, page 6, the statement by the wonderful poet Al-Hawazi, Zion, many nations are beautiful, but no eye has seen the equal of thy beauty. I know not whether the skies bow to thee or whether thou ascendest to the skies. Okay. Is it heaven coming down to earth, or do you rise up to heaven? Okay. But what I can say about this is that from a personal point of view, what is an act of spiritual development or spiritual enlightenment for an individual? Right. What has happened? Has he risen to heaven, or has heaven come down to him? Now, obviously, you know, we're using spatial metaphors here. It's obviously both and neither. Right. But if you're thinking about your path of spiritual enlightenment, it's sometimes really hard to tell. You know, are you reaching up to heaven, or is God reaching down to you? Right. What should your posture be? Should you be, you know, actively going out, or should you be actively receiving? Right. So, and it, the answer can be either or both, right, or is either or both. Okay, so now, this is a quote from the Zohar, which is the main text of the Jewish mystical tradition. The new Zion will restore the glory of the old. For since the destruction of the temple, blessings had been withheld from the world, both on high and here below, so that the lower forces were strengthened. So let me stop there for a second. When it says, right from Genesis chapter 12, the idea that Abraham will be in the land and all these blessings will flow to all of the nations because of Abraham. So Abraham's children are kicked out of the land, so those blessings are cut off. But here something deeper is going on as well. That it's not only down here below on earth that all blessings have been cut off, but the Kabbalistic idea is that heaven is, God is just as alienated and disoriented by the exile as we on earth are. Okay, so it's not just that earth is out of control, chaotic, scrambled, but that the heavens are as well. And that God himself is as well. When the temple was destroyed and the people driven into dispersion, the divine presence took one last look at the Holy of Holies and left her home to accompany Israel into exile. This is such an extraordinarily delicious metaphor. I find it absolutely breathtaking. Imagine the presence of God taking one last look at the Holy of Holies. And then going into exile. It's an image of just incredible passion and pathos. All right. So God himself is in exile, while we are in exile. When she had entered the lands of dispersion, she learned how the people were oppressed and trodden underfoot by the heathen nations. But the day comes when the Holy One will recall the community of Israel, and the Divine Presence will return from exile, restore the sanctuary, build the city of Jerusalem, and raise Israel from the dust. So here, it's not just that the people have been gone into exile. The universe has gone into exile. God has gone into exile as we have been exiled. God has gone into exile with us. So you have this alienation on three different levels. You have the cosmic, the divine exile. You've got the national, collective exile. And you've got the personal exile. And the redemption of one is the redemption of all. All right. In this particular description, it's God who's doing the action. The day comes when the Holy One will recall the community of Israel. But in other places within the Kabbalistic tradition, the Kabbalists talk about, they don't mean it quite this literally, but forcing God's hand. That by them doing the mitzvot in the proper way, with the proper kavanah, with the proper intentionality, we trigger God going through this process that will lead to the redemption. Right? They're seen, sometimes it's seen as causative. You know, God will do this and then this will happen over here. Sometimes it's seen as causative in the other direction. The people will do this and that will trigger something happening in God. And sometimes it's seen as synchronistic, that they'll both happen at the same time. As we do this, God does that. And they're in parallel to each other. Which fits perfectly the idea that there is a parallel between what's happening with the community of Israel, with the nation, with the actual physical nation of Israel, and with the Shekhinah, who's referred to as the community of Israel in Kabbalistic texts, and also with me as an individual Israel, you know, as an Israelite. As an individual Israel, we all find ourselves in a similar position of alienation. We all have to struggle to be able to restore that balance where when the temple is established, then the blessings will flow. There's, again, you've got that image of the centering. Now, so if this is all so important, then how come we had to wait until the 19th century or the 20th century before Israel was reestablished? Okay, how come, you know, you had Jews all over the ancient world, you know, living in wherever they, you know, in Cologne, Germany, or Fez, Morocco, or wherever they were, why weren't they all living in Israel? So, I refer here to Yehuda Levi and his book, The Kuzari. The setup for the book of the Kuzari, you might have heard about the kingdom of the Khazars. People every now and then, about every 30 years, sort of like a malaria, about every 30 years somebody comes up with a theory that Jews today aren't really Jews because we're all descendants of this nation of Khazars that lived in sort of south western Russia near the Black Sea, and they all converted to Judaism and we're all the descendants of Khazars, and so we're not really Jews, we don't really have a link to the land of Israel, blah, blah, blah. Stupid idea. I mean, there's no historical reality to that whatsoever. But there was, in fact, a nation of Khazars. It was, in fact, the case that a certain group of the elite leadership of the Khazars became enamored of Judaism and converted to Judaism. That part is true. Okay. So Yehuda Levi wrote a book where he imagines a disputation in front of a Khazar king, who is considering converting, and the Khazar king has invited a Christian, a Muslim, and a Jew to represent their views about religion. He's going to decide which of these religions he's going to convert to. Okay. So, in the passage we're reading here, Halevi lets the king express what Halevi himself felt so keenly. If Jerusalem is the sacred place on earth for all monotheist religions, if Israel in the past desired to remain in it, if Israel believes that the divine presence will return there, if it truthfully recites the prayer, "Have mercy on Zion, for it is the house of our life," right? If all this is so, how is it that you don't do all in your power to live there? Okay? You're keeping it really simple. You know, every year at Pesach, we say, next year in Jerusalem. You know, what do you mean next year? Call Elal, book your ticket, you can be in Jerusalem tomorrow. Okay. This question, which reaches deep into the historic tragedy of the Jewish people, Halevi does not answer by an apologetic reference to adverse political conditions, an easy thing in the period of the Crusades. So let me back up here. At one answer that he could have given, and rightfully so, is that we're trying to get back, but we can't. Right? Conditions are impossible. Just imagine that you're living in Germany and you want to move to Israel in the year 1100. Okay? Well, so how many different countries do you have to cross through? How many different, you know, how long is this journey going to take when you're traveling by yourself, you know, through all of these three countries that, you know, a dozen different languages? River travel, donkey travel, boat travel, walking endlessly, 6 months of total vulnerability on the road. How many people do you think are really going to be able to do that, you know, and survive it? Yeah. Oh, not to mention the fact that you're in the middle of the Crusades, that there's a war going on. Okay. And that there are people who are actively trying to kill you. You know, so you know, add that into the picture. You know, it really wasn't easy to make Aliyah. All right. So he could have done that. Yehuda Halevi could have come with that explanation, but he didn't. Nor did he come with a theological reference to a plan of salvation which might impose our waiting for the right moment. Oh, well, you have to understand, Your Majesty, we can't just pick up and go, because since we were exiled, because God, thought that we were sinful and he punished us through this exile, it's not up to us to just pick up and go. We would love to, but we have to wait for a divine sign, blah, 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 blah. He could have said that, but he didn't. All right. Instead, he bites the bullet. Yehuda Levi sharply criticizes his people for the sluggishness of their response to the call of Israel's land. The failure to return, he calls Israel's sin. The reestablishment of the covenant between God, Israel, and the land did not and does not depend on historical forces, you know, whether or not you can get a passport or not, or on the inscrutable will of God, you know, who will decide when it's okay for us to come back to Israel, but on the people's decision to enter this covenant. The divine spirit only gives man as much as he is able to receive. Okay. Now, look at that line again. The divine spirit only gives man as much as he is able to receive. So, on the big national collective level, what Yehuda Halevi is saying is that we're not manning up. Okay? And even if God wants us to do this, right, we are not in a state where we can accept that mandate and that would go and all that would go with it. Right? If God himself tells us to do it, we're not in a condition to do it. Right? Our spiritual alienation is too great. So again, the catch-22. If we were living in Israel, we would not be spiritually alienated. But since we are not living in Israel, we are out here spiritually alienated, so when God tells us, if God were to tell us to go back to Israel, we are so spiritually alienated that we wouldn't even be able to hear him say it. Okay? The divine spirit only gives man as much as he is able to receive. So what you need to do then, says Yehuda Halevi, all right, the implication is that that we have to undergo our own personal transformation in order to receive the divine spirit. That's the only way that this will happen. Okay? So we couldn't get back to the land of Israel because we haven't gotten the spirit. We haven't gotten the spirit because we're not in the land of Israel. We have to transcend that individually before we can attack it collectively. Okay. So, but now the question becomes, to what degree, you know, we've been talking about metaphors here. You know, we've been looking at, you know, this statement about national redemption or this statement about national exile as if we should interpret it as a, you know, a personal, you know, statement about our own spiritual development. But to what extent does being in the physical land of Israel, or desiring to be in the physical land of Israel, to what extent is that really at play? And I would venture to say that this is a theme that runs through, or this is an issue, a dynamic that runs through much of Jewish history. And I'll give three examples of it. We know that from 2,000 years ago, when we look at the writings of Philo Judaeus, who was the great, incredibly brilliant philosopher. I've told you the story about Philo, that he is one of the most important intellectual figures. He's probably the single most important intellectual figure that most people have never heard of. Okay, in Western culture. All right, he was a Jewish philosopher writing around the year zero, all right, just before the Common Era, in the Hellenistic Jewish world. And he was the first major writer to be able to combine Greek philosophy with biblical textual orientation. And what he did when he did this was to anticipate virtually everything that everybody had to say about philosophy and scripture up until the time of Spinoza, so that for the next 1,600 years, almost 1,700 years, right, everybody was an echo of Philo. That's how good this guy was. And one of the things that he writes about is that he writes about the challenge of dealing with philosophically oriented Jews who have decided to no longer keep the mitzvot, you know, in a practical sense, because they think that they understand the idea behind the mitzvot. And so that once, you know, this mitzvah is meant to teach us ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. Well, now that I've learned ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, I don't have to do the mitzvah anymore, because that's just a tool. That would be, you know, to continue to do it actually would be as if to, it would be a declaration that I didn't really get the message. So in order to prove that I got the message, I'm not going to do the mitzvah anymore. Okay. Yeah, sounds familiar, Gary. Okay. So we see where the problem lies. Okay, so you have an echo of this going on in Spain in the 1400s, which was a source of great tension within the society, that you had people, and perhaps one of the reasons that people were as willing to convert to Christianity as they were, was because they had already decided that that religion in its sort of simple sense, you know, do this, don't do that, you know, do these rituals, that they had already decided that none of that stuff really mattered. What mattered was sort of the philosophical ideas behind it. So it doesn't matter whether the rituals that I'm supposed to be doing are like kashrut and a mezuzah, or whether the rituals are supposed to be, a rosary and communion, because they're all like, it's the idea behind it that really counts. It's sort of like the new math, right? It doesn't matter if you think that 2 + 2 = 5, as long as you get the idea, right? So that was another example. And we have a third example in the world of New Age Judaism, where people will beautifully mine mitzvot for all kinds of incredible spiritual insights and, you know, life transformation, right? You know, you can talk about tefillin, or you can talk about Shabbat as being, you know, all the cosmic significance, unbelievable. But then, you know, they don't do tefillin or Shabbat because they already got the idea. Right. It is stunning to me that I was blessed to be in a wonderful group of people who were studying to become spiritual directors, in particular Jewish spiritual directors. But very few of them had any familiarity with, you know, traditional Jewish life. Okay, so we were doing all kinds of yoga and journaling and all kinds of wonderful spiritual exercises, and I'm not trying to be critical of those. You know, they're wonderful and powerful, but to do them in the absence of davening or Shabbat or kashrut, you know, in what sense are you a Jewish spiritual director? I mean, I realize biologically it fits, but, you know, chutz mizeh, you know, besides that, like, where is the Jewishness in doing this? So you have these ideas, but no concrete reality. So all of that is meant as an introduction to the next passage, okay? And this is the question about, do you all actually have to go through the land of Israel in order to attain spiritual perfection? All right. So Rabbi Haggai ben Alzuk, who I don't recognize, his name I don't recognize. I'm sure he was a genius, but I don't recognize the name. He said that you didn't actually really need to go through the land of Israel. And Solomon Duran, whose name I do recognize, is one of the truly great rabbinic scholars, late medieval rabbinic scholars. His response is as follows. This is Duran writing about Haggai ben Alzuk. I have seen all that you wrote with regard to immigration to the land of Israel, and you have written much. That's a joke, right? That's, you know, he's saying, yeah, you wrote a lot. Yeah. Okay. Implicit in your words is the notion that perfection of the soul comes about through apprehension of ideas alone, to which immigration to the land neither adds nor detracts. So this echoes back a little bit to what we saw with Abba Lafia and Reb Isaac of Akko, you don't have to actually be physically in the land. You could be in Nome, Alaska, but, you know, there, if you're really, you know, spiritually adept, appropriate, you know, it's as if you are the land of Israel, right? So Reb Solomon Duran is really tromping on that idea here. By way of refutation, Duran objects that Rav Haggai's position is overly intellectualized. It is built on the delusion that it is possible to attain perfection and eudaimonia through the intellect alone. That eudaimonia is roughly harmony of soul. That's possible to do through the intellect alone, whereas in truth, only the commandments bring us to perfection. Hence the importance of the land, which is itself commanded, and which is the locus for the performance of other commandments too. Right. So here you can't only think about the land of Israel as a metaphor, or interpret statements about exile as metaphorical reflections of my alienated spiritual state. That's an interesting exercise, but when push comes to shove, you got to go to Israel. Right? It has to be the real deal. You have to do the mitzvot, and one of the mitzvot, according to Rav Shlomo Duran, is going to Israel. Right? And what we're going to see now are a couple of examples coming from the modern secular Zionist, early Zionist movement, where they're really doing, it's very odd, they are, in a certain way, as secular as they are closer to Rabbi Shlomo Duran than Shlomo Duran is to Rabbi Haggai ben Azuk. Now, even though both of the rabbis were halakhically oriented, you know, traditional Jews, all right, in a way, from a spiritual point of view, the secular Zionists that we're going to be reading now are closer to Shlomo Duran. Redemption of the soil of Israel becomes an act of consecrated worship in much of modern Hebrew poetry, as in the following lines of Abraham Shlonsky. With a shirt wide open, as the open gates of a temple, I caress the morning earth with my toes. Here I lie on the back in mother's lap, and all the rivers run into me, and every tree strikes root in me, and the God of the universe is leaning upon me and whispers to me lovingly, you, you. Again, a stunning statement. My shirt wide open, open as the gates of the temple. Right, you have the image of the Su Sha'arim Roshechem, you know, open the gates. He lies on the back, on his back, feeling the earth beneath him. The rivers run unto me, every tree strikes root in me. He's describing himself as the Garden of Eden. And the God of the universe is leaning upon me and whispers of all things, you. Now you expect God to say me, but he's saying you, because in the modern secular world, all right, the human being now becomes the replacement for God. All right. But by being in Israel, he actually experiences this sense of spiritual redemption, and even if it's the God of the God of the universe, even if the God of the universe is in a kind of role reversal here, at least he experiences the God of the universe. And in this next. From Uri Zvi Greenberg. Uri Zvi Greenberg is an incredibly controversial figure. He had at one point been the darling of the kibbutz movement, and then he sort of turned right politically, and then to the point where people were like so contemptuous with him that, you know, one of them like just wanted, he gave me like the collected works of Uri Zvi Greenberg because he just wanted them out of his library because he couldn't stand to have them there. But he was a phenomenal poet. And God is humanized, is brought down to earth as a means of raising the worth of labor, of investing it with supreme sanctity. The light of ages is shed on everyday tasks. The mere draining of a swamp becomes an emblem of historic connotation. Here's the way it appears to Uri Zvi Greenberg. With you I came to conquer this swamp and to draw toward the sun our submerged Mother Earth. Together we love the waste and salty grounds, which were unto the soles of our feet like the tablets of the covenant, to inscribe on them with green script the Hebrew commandments of conquest. Like a young pillar of fire, I followed you in the morning as you came out to plow the parched fields of the homeland, and I called upon the Shekhinah of Israel as if it were a blessing mother to come and utter the blessing of the resurrection of the dead at every step of yours. So you see how he knows all of our classic imagery, the tablets of the covenant, the pillar of fire, the Shekhinah, Techiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. And he's taking all of that and he's putting it into this kind of secular context. Okay. We are over our time, so I want to conclude. But we'll skip the next passage, but I want to go to the last one on page 7. Okay. I'll preface this by a story. I remember I was at this conference, and somebody was speaking about images of Jerusalem through the ages. And he read some of the really sort of flowery poetry about how wonderful and special and holy Jerusalem is. And he then put it into a sort of modern political context about, dividing the city or not dividing the city and, the Palestinians and so forth, blah, blah, blah. And then he made the comment, he said, after all, when all is said and done, Jerusalem is just like, rocks and trees. And I raised my hand and I said, no, Jerusalem is not just rocks and trees. And there was a world gap between us. Right? That as much as he had a sort of literary and philosophical appreciation for all of the metaphors in all of the poetry about Jerusalem, he couldn't accept the idea that from a metaphysical point of view, a spiritual point of view, Jerusalem really is different.
Good.
He didn't get it. It really is holy. He couldn't see that. Whereas for me, it's the most obvious thing in the world. It's simply not like every place. It simply is different. And not just because, it means something to me but not to somebody else, blah, blah, blah. Forget that. It's metaphysically different. And you see that reflected in Rav Kook here. Okay? The person who wrote this collection said, considering an additional dialectic that complicates the affinity for the land of Israel, the land as means and the land as end. Okay, so what does that mean? All right, the land as means. That would be reflected when somebody says, why do we need the state of Israel? Oh, because Jews, they could get persecuted, they need some place to go. Or they could say, why do we need the land of Israel? Oh, because if you put a bunch of Jews together, the cultural creativity of the Jews will, can unleash all kinds of powerful creative forces, and you'll win all these Nobel Prizes and all this wonderful technology, et cetera, et cetera. Now, both of those statements happen to be completely true, right? But both of them are looking at Jews being in the land of Israel as a utilitarian thing. It helps to do something. It helps to save Jews from persecution. It helps to create wonderful cultural things. Okay. Another way to look at it is to say, no, there is something spiritual that happens when Jews are in the land of Israel, because the land of Israel is like where they're supposed to be, not in order to do X or not to use it to do X, but simply in order to be in it and to experience being in it, that it is an end in itself, not a means to something else. Jews being in Israel is its own goal. It's the source of blessings by itself. So here we have Rav Kook, first part of Chief Rabbi of Israel, in one of his classic essays. It says here in his classic essay on the land of Israel, everything he writes is about the land of Israel. Love for our holy land is the foundation of the Torah, which, by the way, is an amazing statement in and of itself. Right, because if you go to Lakewood, right, and you say that, they'll throw stones at you. Right? But love of the land differs according to different people's level of consciousness. For there are those who love our Holy Land for her precious qualities, while others love it because they recognize in it the essence of physical respite for the community of Israel. But the land is not a superficial thing, not merely the means to an end, to her collective unification, or the strengthening of either her material or spiritual existence. Thus, beyond all rational interpretations, the mysticism of the land of Israel, too, is found in Jewish thought. But it is a mysticism in which the land is not merely a symbol of something else, but an end unto itself. And so, too, the parallel to our own individual spiritual liberation. Spiritual liberation, you don't do spiritual liberation in order to accomplish a goal. The more you set goals as a matter of spiritual liberation, the more you fail at spiritual liberation. That's just not the way it's all supposed to work. Right? There is supposed to be an emptying and a sense of presence, a sense of balance, a sense of centering, not a sense of, all right, I'm here, I need to go there. The whole point of the exercise is to be. The land of Israel is supposed to be. Jews are supposed to be in the land of Israel. Right? Not in order to. That's where we're going. That's the end point. There doesn't need to be anything else beyond that. And if you think there needs to be a beyond to that, that is a symbol of the spiritual alienation in and of itself. I'll conclude with one last image. One of my favorite experiences. One time I was in Israel. I was leading a tour of Christians from Sweden in Israel. And we were staying at the in Tiberias, near the Sea of Galilee. And it was Shabbos. And so all of the Christians went on the tour bus to go to the Christian holy places around the Sea of Galilee. And obviously I wasn't going to go there on Shabbos. And so I went into a synagogue that was the worst synagogue service I'd ever experienced in my life. Right? People davening, no kavanah at all, no sense of community at all, no sense of, certainly nothing beautiful. The only good thing about it was I was sitting next to a recent Ethiopian Jewish immigrant, so I helped him learn Hebrew. You know, I sat there during the service, you know, he was pronouncing the words to me and I was, you know, correcting, you know, the pronunciation. But you know, that was a good thing. But in terms of the spiritual experience in the service itself, it was like, pfft. Right. But then after that, I went down to the water, because Tiberias is on the Sea of Galilee, and this was a time when there had been a huge amount of rain, and the Sea of Galilee was basically as high as anybody had ever seen it. It was like an inch, you know, from like flooding over the flood walls in Tiberias. And people had come from all over Israel to see this because many of them, you know, in their whole lives, they'd never seen the Sea of Galilee look like this. So I walked down and I would see these multi-generational families, you know, great grandparents down to great grandchildren, you know, walking like seven abreast, you know, walking on the promenade. And the sense of fecundity, the sense of at-homedness and the sense of sort of fertility and reproduction and normal life was so deliciously overwhelming that it was like, you know, the Christians were in their holy places, you know, having whatever experience that they were having. I had been in my holy place having whatever experience I was having, but being there, that was being in Israel. So, Hevra, I'll conclude here and let's go and get ourselves some chocolate-covered donuts or whatever.